From NPR Music, it's All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan, and on March 6th, 2012, Taylor Swift hit Bandcamp.
Well, not that Taylor Swift.
Hey there, Lars. Oh, my gosh. No, that is not the one.
Yeah, this is the song Taylor Swift by Speedy Ortiz.
And we're playing this today because we are wrapping up the decade, not just the year, in podcasts. So we have roughly 10 podcasts coming out. We've done one on Beyonce's influence on the 2010s.
We did one on Stan culture.
We did a classical music one, which is just mind-boggling.
There's just so much information in there. Right. I learned so much from that episode.
Both hearing new classical music and the fall of so many legends.
But also the rise of like so many incredible women composers.
Yeah, it's quite a decade. And there'll be more. And this one is on Bandcamp, which is, I know I've watched you for so long, I could peer over your shoulder at any given minute and you're kind of poking around Bandcamp finding music. You've played plenty of things on Viking's Choice, which is the column that you often have on weekly,
right,
on the NPR Music site. And you're a lover of Bandcamp because?
Because I find bands like Speedy Ortiz. I first found Speedy Ortiz through a tweet from a friend, and they linked to that song, Taylor Swift. And I listened to it, I was like, oh, wow, this is so cool. How have I not heard this band yet? For the first time, I felt I could be plugged into music communities that were not immediately my own.
And that's sort of the key here. The mm-hmm. communities is the key word as to probably why we're talking about Bandcamp. Because, you know, listening to music, there's plenty out there. Spotify, Apple Music, subscription things. But we're going to talk on this episode all about Bandcamp communities. We'll talk to Sadie Dupree from Speedy Ortiz a little later about what it means to her as a band. We'll talk to other people. We'll talk to the CEO of Bandcamp and the vision of Bandcamp. But I want to hear just a little bit of like a couple of things of music before we get into it, of the things you love.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the wild thing about Bandcamp. It's not any one thing. Anybody can use it. That's kind of the idea. It's a very...
You don't have to be a subscriber to just listen to a song. Mm-hmm. That's one thing.
And to sign up to use the service as an artist is also free. And so it's been interesting over the last decade to watch different little micro-niche communities kind of flourish and thrive on this platform. And it's wild how different they are, but how they also seem very excited to be all in the same space together. So like, I think of an artist like Perturbator, who makes like this Blade Runner inspired synth music. I found that in 2012.
So something like this? And this is?
This is Perturbator, and he kind of like, he didn't launch, but he kind of helped pioneer and expose a genre of music called synthwave, which really kind of exploded from the Bandcamp community. And like now he's touring international festivals and performing like in front of thousands of people with giant pyrotechnics and everything. I found his record Terra 404 in 2012 and just been watched his career explode since.
Awesome. So what else?
There's also an extremely rich beat tape community on Bandcamp. Basically, a beat tape is like instrumentals for like a hip hop artist. And one of those is a guy who records under the name Knowledge, who eventually would make beats for Kendrick Lamar.
Amazing. Yeah. I'm not going to rap. I'm just going to warn everybody. This is not going to happen. I mean, I'm disappointing people, I know, but what else we got?
In the last few years, London has had an incredible jazz scene. It's fun to just kind of like hop across the pond and get immersed into that work. I'm thinking of somebody named the saxophonist Nubia Garcia. She has this, yeah, just listen to this song. It's so fun.
It's called When We Are.
Thank you.
sweet.
It's great.
And I love that you can just, like, for a buck, just you just own it in any format you want. You choose the format so mm-hmm. you can get real high quality stuff if you want.
If you don't download, the stream is available right. to your collection on any device that you choose to use.
It's a great service. So, and the other cool thing is anybody and everyone can put stuff up, so you find quirks, like crazy quirks.
Yeah, like a slugged themed death metal band.
Okay, what are we going to play here?
It's called Slugge.
Like, oh my God, here, I'm doing this. I'm really, really doing this. It's called Gastronomicon. Are the vocals coming?
They come on a little bit later.
I'm going to skip. Gastronomicon. So there are, the white and blue vinyls are gone. There are 69
nice.
Remaining versions of a special edition, and it ships out in 3 days. I mean, that's a cool thing. You can buy hard physical stuff too,
right.
which I don't usually do, but I love the fact that you can do that.
Yeah, and then when you buy those things, you have like a fan page. Right. And it shows your collection, and it's just a nice little layout, and you get to show it off to anybody who wants to look at it.
And folks want to follow you, they do it by
Total Vibration. That's where you can find me on. If you go to bandcamp.com/Total Vibration, you can find over, I think, 1,200 things that I bought on there.
So let's get into this. You got to talk to the CEO of Bandcamp about philosophy and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, and Ethan Diamond, he founded Bandcamp in 2008. Ever since its existence, fans have paid artists $425 million over Bandcamp, and just $8.1 million in the last 30 days, which is incredible. And another little fun little fact, fans buy about 41,000 records each day, or one every 2 seconds, which is pretty wild to think about. But I talked to Ethan Diamond kind of about the priorities that went into creating Bandcamp in 2008 and how it evolved to make a direct connection between the artist and the listener. So you've told the story many times about a frustrating experience buying and downloading an album from one of your favorite bands, which inspired the genesis of Bandcamp. What were the priorities when you first made Bandcamp? What was the mission?
Well, the mission from the beginning was to help artists succeed, and it was to do that in the financial sense, to make them, you know, help them actually make some money. There are quite a few services that were trying to help artists succeed in sort of the promotional sense. But yeah, at the time we started Bandcamp, doing something as simple as, you know, selling your music directly to your fans was really difficult. This was around the time of MySpace, and there was a plugin called, I think, Snowcap, that allowed you to do that, but it was pretty clunky. And, you know, the deal with MySpace was really that the music was essentially just content against which to show advertising. And we wanted to prioritize something really different, you know, to be able to sell directly to fans and have nothing really get in the way of that.
So let's say I spend $10 on an album from Bandcamp. How much does the artist make from that $10 purchase?
Typically about 80% goes to the artist, so $8. So the way it works is our share is 15% on digital and 10% on physical goods. And then payment processor fees are usually another, sometimes closer to 5%, sometimes closer to 7%, just depending on the circumstances.
I went on the Wayback Machine to load up Bandcamp just to kind of remind me of what it looked like early on.
Yeah.
And apart yep. from the landing page, which was very 2008, yes. I was surprised that not much has changed about the function of the player itself. What are some of the things you needed to add to that early design to accommodate artists over the last decade?
So when we first started, the thought was to make this essentially a white label service for artists who want to sell direct to fans. And so really, you know, the inspiration was the blogging tools that existed at the time. So things like Typepad and Movable Type and Blogger. And the thought being that, you know, if you were a writer, to be able to create a site that was, you know, totally your own and just featured your writing and do that totally, you know, for free, that was really easy to do. But if your musical, you know, if your artistic output was music, it was really challenging. So we wanted to just kind of step to the background, have this sort of, you know, powered by Bandcamp footer. We didn't even need to be in the URL. You could customize the URL. But over time, what happened is people started asking us, like, hey, I want to find other, I want to find more like math rock on this site. And at first, you know, my reaction to that was, well, you know, why do you care? You know, you can just look up math rock in Google. And then, you know, once there were, I think, 10,000 artists or somewhere around there, it started to make sense to me that, you know, hey, you know, maybe people want to have the same sort of experience that we're giving them for this one artist, for all the music that they're browsing. And then once there were, you know, 100,000 artists on the site, it really became clear that there was an opportunity to take advantage of the community that was building here and to have it be not just on the artist side, but to be on the fan side as well, build up a community and use that to drive a lot more sales to artists. So one of the biggest things I'd say that we've changed is building out that community. And, you know, now a fan can have a collection, you can follow fans so that you can discover music by, you know, what they're buying. You can see, you know, people who bought this also bought this. The artists themselves can recommend other bands. So yeah, I think other than that, you know, visually you're right, not much has changed. I think we moved the cover art from the left side to the right side in the last 11 years.
And I think there used to be like a visualizer or something, right? For when you hit play.
Oh, yeah,
song.
Right. Yeah, that was back when, you know, that was back in the Flash days. Yeah. And so unfortunately.
dark times.
Maybe fortunately, I don't know. Yeah, that no longer exists.
Well, I mean, that kind of like brings up a little bit of a bigger, like a philosophical idea behind Bandcamp and why I've been such a fan of it for a while is that when so much of the internet felt and still feels overloaded by choice, this motion to launch fan accounts and for you to be able to follow the artists and have like that direct connection felt quietly radical to me because someone could share the music they chose to buy with friends and curious onlookers. And it felt like a record collection that you could just throw out to the entire world.
Yeah, I think that at the time we initially launched fan accounts, this was right around when there were some social networks. I think it was Facebook that was making it so that, you know, just the act of consuming a song would share that out. You know, this so-and-so is listening to this. And we wanted to kind of do the opposite and set up some friction. So say, you know, this is the music that you care enough about to have actually spent money on. And that gives it, you know, a lot more weight, obviously, and makes ultimately the collection a lot more interesting and I think a lot more valuable for other people as a discovery tool.
There are artists who deeply align themselves with certain streaming services, usually for financial means, but for also much more exposure. Like I think of like Frank Ocean with Apple Music, and he has a show on Beats One where he, you know, plays music that he likes, but also premieres new material. Right. But I think the same could be said of artists who self-identify with Bandcamp. And oftentimes Bandcamp is the only place these artists choose to upload their music. What inspires that devotion, do you think?
Well, I think it's probably the direct connection to the fans that we provide. I think, you know, what we've always tried to do is present somebody's presence, you know, on Bandcamp as them, not us, right? So it's just, this is where somebody can set up shop, interact with their fans, and it's not about, you know, it's not about us, it's about them. And so I think, you know, for the same reason that, you know, anybody wants to just play music and represent themselves in their music, you know, that we just give them a platform to do that. And I think that's, in a lot of cases, I think that's really refreshing.
So in recent years, Bandcamp has launched crowdfunding options for pressing vinyl, and artists can offer fans subscriber-only music. That's, you know, dipping a toe into different forms of competition in the music space. But what do you envision for the next decade of Bandcamp? What is the motivation behind what's next?
So what we've done since the beginning was made it so that our interests are aligned with the artist's interests. And that's what, you know, that's the beauty of a revenue share based business, right? Is that, you know, we only are going to make money if the artist is making a lot more money. So everything that we do is in support of the artist and, you know, and the effect, and it's really about the effect of that, right? It's about the elevation of the musical arts. That's what, you know, motivates me. But every decision we really make comes back down to, is this going to be a good thing for the artist? And so, and just as a side effect for that, of that, you know, it's going to be good for the business. So everything that we're doing right now is, it's about improving the discovery tools inside of Bandcamp. It's about giving fans new and interesting ways to support artists and solving just the problems that we hear about in talking to, you know, our artists and labels. So, you know, the vinyl pressing service that we're launching soon, it's right now just we're still in the pilot phase with that, but it'll be out to all of our artists soon. It's just another example of that. You know, we saw that of the albums that are selling on Bandcamp, only about, it's less than 10% of them have a vinyl edition. It's not because, you know, more wouldn't like that. It's because pressing vinyl is really risky, because it's expensive, it's complicated. It's a kind of a, for a lot of folks, it's a pretty mysterious process. So we saw an opportunity to make that a lot easier. So yeah, we're going to soon be pressing and fulfilling vinyl for artists. And I think that's sort of just one example of the kinds of services that that we can build and are building.
I'm excited to see that happen. I really am.
Yeah, me too.
Cool.
Good. Well, thanks. Thank you.
Thanks for your time, man.
Awesome. Thanks, Lars. Bye.
Bye. That was Ethan Diamond. He's the co-founder and CEO of Bandcamp.
And of course, like you all were talking about, fan engagement is the thing. Finding little microgenres is another cool thing. So you called up Shaka V. Greer, who's a journalist, writes for Bandcamp, but is also a mega fan of Bandcamp, just to like get an idea about how other people discover music, right?
Yeah, Shaka is a journalist based out of Toronto. And one of the fun things she told me is that Bandcamp actually helped her find music within her own backyard.
That's amazing.
And we also talked about how she digs for new music. She loves soul music and was kind of missing a lot of the sounds that she loved, and she found it on this platform.
I think I am very rudimentary. I'm very simple about it. I kind of pick a genre and I'm curious and I go into it that way. I'm often attracted by covers of albums. I'm very visual, so the artwork that a lot of artists choose on their album draws me in, and I kind of just follow it where it goes. And oftentimes I'll find an artist who's interesting, listen to their sound, and I'll maybe Google them and read about them a bit, and they'll usually mention artists that influence them or who they've worked with, and that usually leads me back to Bandcamp to discover other voices.
You talked about how album artwork can appeal to you, and the same with me when I'm and I'm curious if you use Bandcamp's, they have like a feed of like if you follow other fans, if you follow record labels or bands, and it just shows you like a large feed of like everything that they've recently uploaded. And sometimes I'll just go through that, and if I see some album artwork that particularly strikes me, I'll hit play and hope that it's good.
Oh yes, I do that all the time. It's funny because I find that when you delve in one way, you do get caught in the rabbit hole because you see how either an artist have grown or have not grown and who they've worked with. But I find the album cover can be very deceptive. And I've learned that, especially being a soul columnist, because I literally try to listen to all the soul albums released during that month. So I've come to just click on everything. I'll listen to everything. I give it a 2-3 song tryout, and if it doesn't grab me, I move forward.
So let's keep going with that. You are a music journalist, and you write a monthly column for the Bandcamp Daily, and as you said, you round up kind of the best soul music on that site. Now, When I think of soul music, my brain goes to rap and R&B stations or like videos on MTV, which dates me a little bit. Is the soul music found on Bandcamp different than what's on the radio?
Incredibly different. First, with soul music, I find soul music, true soul music, very different than R&B. Soul music is the marriage between gospel and R&B. And some of the best artists in the 90s who kind of created the neo-soul version were Erykah Badu and Maxwell and D'Angelo. And what I find is the radio doesn't really play soul music, definitely not modern soul music. If you listen to throwback radio stations, you'll hear maybe Aretha Franklin and you'll hear Ray Charles, James Brown, like the true original soul artists. Then you'll hear maybe Erykah Badu, but there's this big space where soul music is just not played at all. And Bandcamp was the first space that I found where I'm hearing music that to me feels and sounds like soul music. It's completely different than what you hear on the radio.
Why don't you give me an example of something like that?
So there's a great artist. I think she's actually from Washington. Her name is Cecile. She goes by one name. She's released these small EPs, but she has a stunning voice. She's reminiscent of Minnie Riperton, who was a great soul artist in the 70s. And I listened to her EP. She's made my list twice, last year and this year. And she made my Best of Soul in 2018. And I listened to her voice and her songwriting, and it's gorgeous stuff.
What would you like to play from Cecile?
She has a great release from her second EP, I believe, called Awakening. And the track I love is Set Myself Free.
This sounds great. I love
this.
Oh my gosh.
She makes stunning music. Great. She's a fantastic songwriter and an authentic songwriter, which I love.
You shared a list of artists that you discovered on Bandcamp with me, and I happen to see that they're all from Toronto, and I'll share that list with our audience as well on our podcast page. But
well, first of all, I have to say, I noticed after sending it to you that it was very local-based. And I think, interesting enough, Bandcamp helped me discover music in my own backyard.
That's amazing.
Yes. We're typically in Toronto and Canada inundated with American sounds, which we love. But Bandcamp is great to exposing you to music everywhere.
Is there any one sound or aesthetic to these artists?
I would say no. I think these are some of the most experimental artists. For example, Han Han, she's Filipino-Canadian and she raps. And she has chosen not to rap in English. She uses her mother tongue and uses a lot of traditional instruments from her country. Tasomancy, which are two twin sisters, they named their band after their grandmother who read tea leaves. I don't know how to describe their sound. They're orchestra, they're pop, they're very experimental. I think what I have found is that all these artists are exploring music on their own terms and really going against what you hear on radio, commercial radio. They're adventurers musically, And I think that's what I love most about artists.
Let's listen to a little bit of Tessie O'Mansey.
Okay. True love's hair will be on the bus, token as though we're alone. And I feel deep down like something has conspired.
You had mentioned that Tessie O'Mansey was one of the artists that was kind of about your wheelhouse, but you mm-hmm. found through different Bandcamp rabbit holes. But I'm curious, besides looking at album artwork, what are some other methods that you use to find new music through this platform?
I really rely on the editorial arm now. Just I contribute, but I actually am a fan of it, and I read all the writers, and I have discovered the wildest albums just through the editorial. For example, a writer wrote about this album by a band called the Young Ones of Guyana, and it was made in 1970. My family's from Guyana, and there's little music I've heard of from that space. And if it wasn't for a writer kind of digging up these treasures from labels that are putting it onto Bandcamp, I would never have discovered it. So I think the editorial arm has become the big space for me to find new rabbit holes, because all journalists bring a different interest to Bandcamp, and it's opened my listening appetite.
You're talking about Bandcamp Daily, which is a site that I also read pretty regularly. Yes. How can people find both the work of Bandcamp Daily and yourself on that site?
So Bandcamp Daily, you can go to daily.bandcamp.com, and it's updated daily. And people can check out my website, shakavgreer.com. So that's shakavgreer.com.
Thank you so much, Shaka.
Thank you.
That's great. We should go take a break. And when we come back, you're going to talk with Sadie Dupuis from Speedy Ortiz. You talk about how she discovers music on Bandcamp and how she uses it as an artist and what it means to her as an artist. I'm here with Lars Gotrich. I'm Bob Boylan. And you're listening to All Songs Considered from NPR Music.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from American Mensa, the high IQ organization that offers intellectual stimulation and a place to socialize with smart people like yourself. Your high intelligence is the passport to compelling Mensa groups, events, and publications. If you think you may be eligible for membership, take Mensa's admission test or qualify using one of 200 other supervised tests that are accepted. Visit americanmensa.com/join to take the next step today.
I'm Bob Boylan. We are covering the end of the decade here on All Songs Considered. We're doing 10 podcasts looking at moments or things in this decade that were important to the formation of music, formation of artists, artist development. We all think about Spotify and Apple Music as these main platforms, which did certainly alter the landscape in the 2010s. But we're focusing on Bandcamp, which is for people who really love to dig into music, into the unknowns, into the little worlds, something Lars Gotrich loves to do. His Viking Choice is usually all about that. We thought that was a platform worth examining. And so Lars is here. And you talked to Sadie Dupuis of Speedy Ortiz, also put out music under Sad 13. And you talked to her what it means to be an artist on Bandcamp.
Yeah, Sadie, both of her bands are on Car Park Records. You know, her music is on Spotify and Apple Music. A lot of artists are on those places. And the thing that a lot of them are frustrated by is not only the kind of like the sad streaming royalties that they get at the end of every year or every quarter or whatever, but also kind of like the lack of control and access to their music. Because As Sadie says in this interview, she just wants people to hear her music. And if there's a barrier to entry, any barrier to entry, she doesn't really want to be that involved in it. And so we talk about that. And we talk about like her early experiences with the platform, why she wants to be there, how it helped her book her first US tour. And we also talked about how Bandcamp allows her projects like Speedy Ortiz and Sad 13 to offer music that isn't on the major streaming platforms. So she can donate proceeds from those tracks to things that she cares about, which you can't do anywhere else. Mm-hmm. But first, we talked about like the very first music that she put out on Bandcamp. Which was 2011.
I had home recorded a bunch of material where I played every instrument, very, very low fidelity. And it was music I wanted to share with friends. I wanted to be able to play shows under this project. But in a way, I felt it was more of a mixtape than a real album. And it seemed like making it available for free was a cool way for people to get engaged with it. That was sort of the impetus to have it up on Bandcamp.
Was there an artist that you discovered early on when you were first using the platform?
I can think of bands that, if anyone seemed cool, I would just buy their tape. So there's plenty of tapes I have in my house now that are people I'm friends with years later. They'll come over to my house and be like, hey, that's my tape. Swamps, I remember, from Syracuse was one of the early ones I got in the mail, which went on to be members of Perfect Pussy. Initially, it was just kind of checking out my friends and then, oh, who did my friends recommend? Like, let me check out their tape. And then as we sort of got further into it, I mean, there's plenty of people that Speedy's taken out as support bands who at the time, I didn't really hear anyone talking about. Mitski and Alex G were two that we kind of found on Bandcamp, became obsessed with and asked to open for us back at a time when that wasn't a preposterous thing.
So I kind of dug through some of your old tweets, which is always a dangerous thing. And I found some evidence for not only your fandom, but also kind of an alignment of sorts. So this one is from December 6th, 2012. You tweet, your new fan site is cool, but I wish it would account for things that are on Bandcamp that I bought IRL and not on Bandcamp. And you were just kind of talking about this a little bit. You know, sometimes when I'm at a show and I buy a cassette tape or a record, I secretly hope there's a card with a Bandcamp download inside of it. Like,
sure.
I want my friends or followers to see that album in my Bandcamp collection. Do you feel a similar sense of loyalty?
Yeah, I think for a very long time, I primarily listened to music on a physical medium. I'm one of those obsessives about archaic, stupid websites that no one else likes to use anymore, like Last.fm. I think I'm the only person I know who still has a tweakly.fm posting whatever I streamed that week, which doesn't really account for what I've been listening to all week since so much of it is on cassettes or records. So I think as someone who likes to promote other musicians and let people know about things I'm excited by, I always want a way to let people know, like, hey, I listened to your record 30 times this week.
Okay, this one is from October 6th, 2013, and it's a reply to another band. Quote, math rock Bandcamp, quote, post-punk Bandcamp, quote, angular guitars Bandcamp, the Google searches that resulted in our first U.S. tour. I love that tweet. I imagine there's a real anxiety around booking a tour, especially early in your career. You don't really know venues in, like, Cleveland, but you have the benefit of Googling like-minded bands in those cities to forge friendships or partnerships. What made you think to search for bands this way?
I think a similar thing of moving away from MySpace is the way to do everything. It used to just be that you'd click on the city and search through all the bands on MySpace and hope that one of them had any shared aesthetic value with you, and you might not get very lucky. With Bandcamp, I think something that was very cool was sort of the self-categorization of the tags. I don't think I'd really seen a music networking site have something like that before, so it became very easy to find other bands who might share influences in common, who might take pity on a poor touring band who'd never played, you know, Columbus or something before. So yeah, I think I made a lot of early friends in Speedy Ortiz just from searching those kinds of tags, like, what genre of music do I think we sound like? Who might be receptive to playing with us?
Can you tell me about any of those bands? Do you remember some of them that you found that way?
Yeah, I think Geronimo from Chicago was one of those bands. I think a lot of the bands that ultimately became exploding in sound bands were just people who were uploading things onto Bandcamp and having kind of a similar aesthetic goals.
What does it tell you when an artist makes the conscious decision to upload perhaps only to Bandcamp, you know, not on Spotify or Apple Music? Like, why do you think they want to be there first?
It's certainly where I want to be first. And for me, it's because of the accessibility factor. I remember when we first started working with Car Park, it was sort of the standard for them to only have a couple songs as previews on Bandcamp. And this was a time also, of course, where everything's going to digital distribution. So, but if you're subscribing to a streaming service, you have access to hear everything and try out the whole album and decide if you want to buy it. And it seemed kind of wrong to me that there had to be a buy-in for checking something out and deciding whether you want to have a physical copy in your home or download it. So we kind of petitioned them to have all of our records available to stream for free on Bandcamp without one of the expiration things where you can only hear it a few times. And I think that's now a much more normal practice for artists who are similarly concerned with these issues of accessibility, of not wanting someone to have to pay a subscription to a company that's not going to pay me very much out of that subscription for our music to be heard and checked out and hopefully enjoyed.
Does the money you make on Bandcamp exceed streaming services?
Yeah.
Are you seeing, like, on a week-by-week basis, like, a regular revenue of cash, like, basically coming in from Bandcamp?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of it goes through our label, so I'm not getting every email notification about, for instance, if someone buys, you know, our first record we did with Car Park. But some of the early stuff I uploaded myself, and I'll get just about every day all kinds of notifications from Bandcamp about someone spending $6.66 on a single or whatever. I think that's also a component that results in a little bit of extra revenue, people liking to be playful and sort of make themselves known and let you know that they're supporting you by putting in a little note or making the pay what you want price something silly.
Well, is there something on Bandcamp that you haven't put on streaming services? Perhaps something that feels more at home there than on a Spotify or Apple Music?
I believe there are. And this is the one thing I did want to talk about Bandcamp. Something that we started doing kind of early on was putting up tracks for fundraising purposes. And I think the Pay What You Want feature is really crucial for that. I think we started with, we did a track for, or it might have been that we did all of our weekend sales went to benefit the Ferguson Library. We supported the Baltimore Food Bank maybe around that time too. It's a really great way to get people, again, like giving to a cause that they might not otherwise be aware of or think to donate to, and then they get some music for free, and it's not such a bad deal for them. So we've always really appreciated the ability to use Bandcamp for fundraisers like that, and it's something we continue to do. And I believe we have a few songs up on Bandcamp that aren't on other streaming services.
You put up the song Screen Gem in 2017. What cause did that benefit?
That was to benefit Close Rikers.
Cool. Well, we should go out on that and take a listen. And thank you so much, Sadie, for your time.
Yeah, thanks for chatting about this.
That's great, Lars. I learned a lot about a platform I already love. I actually use it as an artist, put stuff up there. Bandcamp's really special. And it's nice to know we heard from the CEO about how they plan to grow and change, all in the spirit of helping the artist. And gosh knows, there just aren't that many people who have that sort of conviction, and it really shows.
And the thing that, like, maybe is important to drive home is that this decade in particular has felt like content consumption overload. Like, there are just so many ways to watch movies, so many ways to read books, so many ways to listen to podcasts, so many ways to listen to music, and it feels like so much. And the thing that Bandcamp does is it allows you to take ownership of the thing that you love. Mm-hmm. And put your own money, put your money where your mouth is, you know, and say, I love this so much that I want to support it. And I think that's something that we need to be thinking about more, because as independent creators frequently get crushed out of those big corporate entities, we need to be thinking about how musicians can forge ahead and, you know, really thrive. And I think Bandcamp has proven to be a really strong supporter of that scene.
Beautiful. Lars Gotrich, thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
And Bandcamp, thank you. More decade coverage coming up in the All Songs Considered podcast. Stay tuned. Here's Speedy Ortiz for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.
We were the kings of midnight. I was your girl, you were my son.